Mini episode 90 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at sportsology.info.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to a very special segment here today on the Sportsology platform. This is Rick Morris from the FDH Lounge. I am joined today by Russ Cohen of the FDH Lounge and Sportsology, who graciously is hosting this here and participating today. Russ, we have a very, very special conversation with a gentleman, and I know that this certainly it cuts near and dear to the heart of both of us, but especially you, for as much of a super fan as you are.
Yeah, John Anderson is just, you know, one of my favorites. He's just a great singer-songwriter. He was the real engine behind Yes. He's a great performer. People, if they hadn't seen him, might not realize how many instruments he could actually play. He plays the harp, which I find absolutely incredible, in the sense that I don't know of any rock band that can just bring out the harp and have somebody play it. So I think that that's kind of an interesting thing. He's a very spiritual guy, always very positive with his music. You know, if you go to his store on Amazon, you'll see he's just got a multitude of albums. A lot of them now have been, he's starting to convert to MP3, which is nice. So he's really enduring, you know, and that's a big thing.
Well, what better way to set that up? You did so very well, Russ. And, of course, the hub for all of this, where people can find the information, is at John Anderson Online. That's johnanderson.com, J-O-N-Anderson.com. And I believe we have him on the phone lines here. It's a pleasure to be able to welcome him in. Legendary, longtime Yes lead singer and solo artist John Anderson. John, welcome to the program today. Pleasure to have you on, sir.
Thank you very much. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Yes. We can hear you
Excellent.
Loud and clear.
Excellent.
It's wonderful to have you on, sir. We have a bunch of questions to get to here, to pick your brain about your career, where it's been, where it's headed. First question that I would have is, in looking at the long stretch that you have behind you, the tremendous catalog from when you were lead singer of Yes, your highest profile work, when you look at the commercial success of the period of the 80s, specifically the 90125 album versus the progressive rock thing when you guys were really pioneers of that back in the 70s, do you have a chapter out of those two that cuts a little nearer and dearer to your heart, or do you kind of embrace it all equally?
I think it's very important to go through the 70s music and realize that we were one of the bands that, you know, used the progression of music, you know, rather than stick to the possible sort of hit record sort of situation. And I remember in the early 70s, you know, we were always making music to perform on stage. I think that was what Yes was all about, performance. And then we'd make records. We were very lucky to sell records. And we never really had a big hit single until Roundabout, and then after that, the record companies sort of said, well, please make another Roundabout, or please make another hit record. And all I wanted to do was to create music that was good for stage and presentation on stage. So we jumped into that world of long-form pieces of music. And I think that's what sustained us through into the 80s. And then, of course, we were very lucky to have a big hit record in 84. And it was a different world, totally different world for us.
John, I think you're being nice when you say luck, in the sense that, you know, I followed your career for a long time and I've been to a lot of your shows, solo and otherwise, and you are a storyteller. I mean, that's the way I sort of see you, and always in concert, you're always telling at least one or two stories, and you always sort of project that to the audience, and I sort of get that from your writing too. I think that's something that you just have a natural talent at.
Well, I was going through what a lot of people go through. When we became famous, we had success. I was kind of thinking, well, why me? You know, why did I get the success? And, you know, so many people out there that are really good at what they do. Mm-hmm. And yet there I was with a band of very, very talented musicians. And that's what sort of set me on this sort of path of trying to figure out why we live and what our spiritual life is really all about. So in the early 70s, I was reading a lot about Herman. I was reading Herman Hesse quite a lot. And he really wrote about this non-religious sort of pathway to an understanding of why we live and et cetera. And I think I wanted to put it into musical form. So when you look at the songs like Close to the Edge and the Topographic Period, mm-hmm. I was really in this sort of wonderful world of, seeking and waking up lyrically and musically and totally experiencing this incredible story of where I was going. So that's what I kept doing all the way through to yesterday. I'm still doing it, you know?
Right. Well, you must have a lot of people that come up to you in the business and tell you that you've been an inspiration. Just recently, I interviewed Carl Verheyen, who's a guitarist for Supertramp, and he told me he could still play the entire Close to the Edge album. Like, he could just do it, pick it up tomorrow and play that. And that's got to make you feel pretty good that a lot of your work is still so, you know, so revered.
I feel really, really proud that we did that experience and went through it, and the fans stayed with it. A lot of the fans just kept coming to see the shows all the way through till, gosh, about 6 years ago. And one of the interesting things is you get a lot of young people coming to the show that I do now, the solo show, and you see them looking at me, and they've got Close to the Edge, a CD in their hand, and they want me to sign it sort of thing. And I can see in their eyes, they've got this look of, what were you thinking about when you made this music, you know? So I feel very, very proud of what I've been musically able to do over the years.
John, it's very interesting because the conversation that Russ just referred to, I know that he had mentioned to me that it came up that he wasn't really thrilled by some of the sampling that had been done of some of Supertramp's music. Versus, I know that when Kanye West sampled your vocals from High Places, from what I've seen, you seem to be pretty flattered by that. So have you thought about proactively moving into that a little bit more, possibly seeking out some other artists or bands for collaboration, either for sampling or mashups?
Yeah, I actually sent about three new songs to a guy who does mashups and suggested a couple of other things that I've done just about 2 months ago. As for collaboration, I'm always very open. A friend of mine from Italy got in touch with me last month. Would I sing on a song of this wonderful composer in Italy? And I sang the song about a month ago. I sang it one day and sent it to him, and they just released it this week. So it's available on Amazon. And the guy that wrote the music is called Marco Sabbio. And you know, I wrote the melody and the lyric, and it's all about limitless, we're living a limitless life. We should never limit ourselves. And I thought it was such a wonderful idea that I sang the song. So, you know, I think later this year I'll be down in Brazil working with young musicians, doing a special concert for Earth Day.
So oh, nice.
I'm just very open to trying out and working with different people. So that's the way it should be.
John, I noticed, you know, early in your career, you had done some Beatles covers, and I wonder, were they sort of an inspiration to you when you were growing up?
Well, it's one of the things I sing in my concert. I'll be playing here tonight, my solo show. I sing a song about me and my brother, because we were, you know, we worked on the local farm. We used to sing Everly Brothers songs and Beach Boys songs. And, of course, the Beatles, when they started, we actually went to see them just before they became famous. And nobody screamed. Everybody listened. And they were an amazing band. And, you know, me and my brother had a band called the Warriors right there in 63. And we played at the Cavern in Liverpool. So they were an incredible influence on our lives completely.
John, in terms of the adventurous nature that you've shown, as far as things that you've been willing to do, different genres that you've taken on, you've certainly gone further as a solo artist than most other people that I can think of here, really, as far as whether it be doing the score for a ballet or doing a little bit of Latino or Celtic flavored music. I know that you've been tooling around with some of the old Yes tunes and doing a little bit of repurposing in an acoustic sense. I wonder to what extent you've thought about marrying some of your solo approaches to that, of possibly trying to redefine some of the old Yes stuff in a completely different way, not just go acoustic with it. Have you thought about that at all?
Well, I'm doing a concert in the summer at the Olympic Games in London with the Slovakian orchestra and a small ensemble.
Nice.
And they want to do the Yes songs. And I said, well, we've got to do them totally in a different way, more semi-acoustic with an orchestral. I do have some orchestral scores, so I'm sending those over this week, in fact. And I know it'll be sounding different, but it's still the same core energy of the song. The song really carries everything. And then when I do my solo show, I'm doing songs that people know very well from Yes, that I wrote for the band, and I just take them in that original form that I wrote them on guitar. So in some ways, I think sometimes the audience are listening to the song, but they've got their own feeling of, oh, I can hear the Yes music dancing around it, you know, sort of thing. And it's just a very interesting idea that music is very open and should be. You know, you shouldn't really have to have it exactly as it used to be or exactly as it was, because music can evolve no matter what.
Yeah, I like that. And actually, like on my iPod, I have a lot of different live shows of Yes and You and different things like that, because I always do like the way songs sound differently in each show. But I was going to ask you, for this tour, are you breaking out the harp? Because I always thought that was amazing that you're the only guy I know that plays it in sort of a progressive rock way. And, you know, you had it on Awaken and other songs. And I'm wondering if you're bringing it to this tour.
Well, I'm doing Awaken this summer, so I'll be using the harp then. Not on my solo. I tried it once. But for me, the harp is such a delicate energy that I'd start playing it in the show, and then I'd feel like I was drifting away, and I would play it a little too long, you know, and then I didn't want to lose the audience, so I thought I'd better get back to a song they know. Because the harp can be very, very, I don't know, enticing. You just get up, I play it at home, and you get into that dream world. It's beautiful.
Well, John, you've been at this. I'm sorry, you've been at this obviously for an awful long time here, from the beginnings of Yes and everything you've traced through over the course of your career and accomplished a lot. Of course, back when you first started out, there really was no internet outside of academia and the Pentagon and the few places that existed that none of us had ever heard of. But right now, I mean, you've been doing a very good job, it seems to me, with your website. And also, I was checking out your Facebook page as well there. You've got a lot of followers on there, and you're doing a good job of updating what happens on tour. As things go along, how have you learned to leverage social media to be able to keep up with your fans and just help broaden and deepen the relationship with your very devoted fans?
It's a constant doorway. It's opening very slowly for me. I've always wanted to do some really important stuff via my website. It's just a slow process because technically I can't do what I want to do. I've already been working with people for the last 6 years on the internet, just sending MP3s to each other and writing music. So I released an album last year called Survival and Other Stories, and all the songs were working with people, a guy in Australia, a guy in Italy, a guy in France, a guy in L.A., in New York, in London, just different people in Romania. And I just kind of felt, well, I'm doing this so much, and I must have about 50 songs that are just sitting there waiting to be put out, and I'm not quite sure how to get them out there. I'll figure it out one day, but you keep putting records out, and of course, There's no record companies, so you put about, like I released Open on my birthday just last October, because I just didn't have the correct way to release it. So I thought, why not just put it out there? People will find it.
They do. And actually, I have a friend who just told me yesterday, when he knew that you were coming on, he had just gotten his records back from his brother after 25 years, and he listened to Animation. And that's something where you've got to be pretty happy, where in the MP3 world and the digital world, that now some records that were out of print and maybe didn't make it on CD will certainly get out there again.
Yeah, it's funny because, you know, when I look for music that I'm interested in, I'll get on the internet and just Google it and try and find. I'm very interested in Ethiopian music, the old school style.
Okay.
And I go there once a week just to listen to some music from way, way back. And it, because for some reason, it's American music. And if you listen to it, there's a lot of reggae, there's a lot of calypso, there's a lot of jazz and all many fusions that come out of Ethiopia from the old school of their music. And without the internet, I wouldn't have been able to do that.
And actually, the that same person had a question about the Animation album. He the song was the subject of your daughter, he told me. I wasn't even sure of that. And then he was wondering who the kids were that were singing on the song Surrender.
Oh, yeah, these are my children when they were just little, you know, 5 and 6 years old, 7 years old.
Okay.
And they had some other friends from school, and they all came around one afternoon for a party at the house, and I got them singing along, you know. And the song, the main song, Animation, was about the birth of my third child, Jade, and it was just the idea of the incredible wonder of childbirth and the idea of how we come into this world and the extraordinary feelings that you get as a father. And it sustains that kind of song. It's something that, it's one of the things about writing music. You know, you record a song, you put it together, you hear it through the speakers, and you just go into this sort of wonderful bliss of, wow, this is just sounding great. And I hope somebody else can hear this. And that's why you put out music and you send out music via the record or whatever. You just hope somebody gets what you get as an artist.
Well, like for a song like And You and I, like any time I put it on, I sort of do get a feeling like that. And I was wondering, when you did write that song, what sort of mood were you in? Like, what kind of headspace were you in for that one?
Well, I get that same feeling when I sing it every show. But when we first recorded it, I started the idea, and then Steve joined in, and, you know, me and Steve put together the shape, and everybody in put their ideas into it. And when we started to listen back to the production through the speakers, you get a strange feeling. You get a feeling of, I don't know, you feel like a oneness with the universe.
Mm-hmm.
And something sounds so beautiful back to you after you've put some work into it. You put your heart and soul into a song, and then you hear the playback for the first time and how it all sounds, and you just sit there thinking, gosh, this is so beautiful. Thank you. Whoever's helped us put this together, thank you very much, you know.
Well, yeah, that's got to be a tremendous feeling. And I was looking at, you had put out a live album, Live from La La Land, and I got a kick out of the title there. And I was looking at, you know, the set list, and you had Wondrous Stories on there. And that to me still is such a great enduring song that it's short and sweet. And fans always react well to that in concert. They always love that.
Yeah, I remember actually writing that song. I just woke up that morning, and I saw my two kids asleep in bed, and went downstairs and wrote the song, went down to the studio. We were in Switzerland at the time. Went down to the studio with the song completely there, and we recorded it that afternoon. And when I sing it on my show, it just feels like a strong connection with my whole life experiences, you know?
Mm-hmm.
John, in terms of finding inspiration for writing music, I mean, so much of what you're talking about sounds like it just flows so naturally, but do you find yourself at times ever having to set up certain patterns in your life to be able to find that kind of inspiration? Are there periods in time where you have to work to put yourself in a certain place to kind of have the ideas flow to you, or have you been fortunate enough over a period of time to where things have just basically kind of come to you without having to seek them out that hard?
It's a combination of things, really. You think about the music that comes to you. Sometimes somebody will send me a piece of music. Just 2 weeks ago, a friend of mine sent me a piece of music. He played the piano, and I'm trying to think about a melody, and I start singing a melody, and all I could think about was a blame, the word blame, B-L-A-M-E.
Mm-hmm.
Who's going to take the blame for the mess that we're putting ourselves in? And it's only because I've been watching the politicians on TV with the debates and things, and their lack of understanding of the true world that we're surrounded by, and their lack of appreciation for the people that are supposed to be representing, and will they take the blame when they don't come through with their promises, etc. And you try to put that into words, and that's one of the things that I'm always juggling with. It's fascinating to be able to go through that experience of wanting to say something, but not really to say it too obviously. You want to do it with a more metaphor experience lyrically, and try and get through to the truth of things. So that's what I was going through 2 weeks ago with a new song.
It's a pretty dark place, John. If you're using the political debates for inspiration, you're bound to end up writing an album of death metal or something. That's a pretty dark place to go for inspiration.
Well, unfortunately, people are gullible enough to believe them. And they actually look and sound like they're up to something. Because one or two of them are very honest and very clear.
Mm-hmm.
I really like Obama. I think he's just been messed around by government.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's had beautiful, wonderful ideas. He's helped America so much. You know, I became an American 2 years ago, so I have a strong feeling about being part of the American dream. And I want people to say the truth, and I want people to try and work together. And it's very hard to understand why people just don't want to work together on a really good plan to make America such a... It's an incredible place to live, that's for sure.
Yeah,
and
I
travel the world, so I come back to America. I'm so thankful that I do live in America. But I think sometimes it'd be so wonderful if people would get on and learn to work together.
That's a great point.
It's interesting, John, because we are such a collection. We are such a melting pot of influences around the world. And just in this conversation alone, you've referenced, obviously, England and Ethiopia and Brazil. So... It's strange, but you could almost kind of look at that as becoming an American as sort of a metaphor for your career, because you've gone to so many influences in the course of your musical career, just like the melting pot that this country represents.
Yeah, it's interesting. When I first came to live here 25 years ago, one of the first things that really shocked me was that there's no connection to the indigenous people of this part of the world. There's no connection with Native Americans. It's as though America tries to continue without having them as part of the evolvement of America itself. And it just seems so bizarre to me.
Yeah, I could understand why. John, I have a two-part question for you. You've been able to really hold on to your voice all these years, and I've seen other people in music and rock have trouble with that, and we've seen that even Benoit David, who was in Yes recently, had trouble with his voice. What happens on tour that just, is it so demanding?
I think the longer tours were, you know, when you're 40 and you're 30, you're 40, whatever, 45, 50 maybe, long tours, constant touring, you're used to it. Your body can sustain it. But when you get older, like I was getting into my 60s, those longer tours where you don't have a break, from a vocalist point of view, it's very hard. From a guitarist, a drummer, they're just using their hands and their arms or legs, whatever. from a singer, you're using a very delicate instrument. So that's one of the problems that I went through. And a lot of singers go, you know, they oversing. And Benoit probably went through that where he oversang for a week or two and then suffered a month later while he was still on tour. And unfortunately, the guys in the band just didn't really care. And they, even when I got very sick, you know, they weren't, you know, weren't really, what's the word, compassionate. They weren't compassionate.
No, they didn't seem that at all.
Was. Yeah. Rick Wakeman was very, very definitely on my side because he's been ill in his life and he knows what it's like. So for that to happen, you know, it just seems such a sad thing for Chris and Steve to just let happen, you know, and Alan. They should really have let him know either. They didn't let him know that he wasn't in the band. And I think that's the kind of thing you see, wait a minute, there should be more compassion around because, you know, it's only music, guys. And life is more important. Health is more important. So
I'm
kind of lucky. You know, I'm very happy with my life. My wife, my Jane, she looks after me so much. And touring, we just take our time in touring so that I can do a performance because that's really what it's all about, being able to do your best.
No, that's great. Also, there's some fans of yours in the Montreal area that want to know, will you get back that way? There seem to be a pretty good amount of fans there. Did you ever notice that over the years? Were they a good area for you?
Oh, gosh, yeah. There's the whole, for some reason, you know, Canada has always been a great place for me to go and perform. Montreal, Quebec, Toronto. So we might actually, me and Jane, we might be up in Montreal sometime in, I think, May.
Okay.
But that'll be just for a sort of maybe a TV project that we've been approached about. So we'll see what happens. But I'd love to go up there and do a performance. Maybe while I'm there, I'll do a club date or something.
Well, John, we certainly want to get some plugs in here for your dates that you've got going on. Of course, today, March 3rd, Hamilton, Ohio. March 5th, Wilmington, Delaware. You go back to the East Coast after today. March 7th in Philly. March 8th, Baltimore. March 10th, New York. March 11th, Washington, D.C. Of course, this can all be found at johnanderson.com, JLNAnderson.com. And it certainly looks like it's a very exciting venture for you right now, heading back out there and getting a chance to perform this music. You sound like you're in a really good place creatively.
Yeah, I've just been, I spent January writing some new songs and just this East Coast shows. I put together a few more songs, new songs that I put together, a couple of new stories to tell. And heading down to Europe in the summer, then down to Brazil. And but I have some work to do, you know, April, May, a project that I want to finish when I get home. So I'm in a very good place creatively and very, very happy and thankful. It's been wonderful speaking to you guys.
Well, we appreciate it, too. My last question for you is, when you started all those years ago, did you imagine that you would still be creating and still be working now? Was that ever a thought?
Gosh, if I said yes, that would be crazy. You know, you think you've got a thing going with the first band and maybe the last two or three years we started, yes. You think maybe this will go for a couple of years. We'll be lucky if we can keep it going. And then 20 years later, you're thinking, I can't believe this is happening. And 40 years later, I'm in my 50th year now as a professional musician. It's kind of amazing.
Well, still going strong. It's an amazing career, John. We're having a great time following you, as are all of your fans. Thank you so much for having been with us today. We can't thank you enough.
Thank you. I wish you well.
Thanks, John.
Appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
Excellent. Want to thank John Anderson for having come on today. And, Russ, an excellent joint segment here of Sportsology and the FDH Lounge. Thanks so much. This was tremendous.
Yeah, it was a thrill. Really a thrill for me, I have to tell you.
This really, really was. Well, we appreciate everybody tuning in. Catch us again sometime soon, Sportsology and the FDH Lounge.